from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody. This is Daphne Farhat speaking from the People Speak radio show. We here at the People Speak, we believe when the people speak, we can make a difference. Some of the people that have been speaking out in the country these days are important and influential. One of them, Reverend Lennox Yearwood, Jr., is an American minister. He's an activist. He is a hip-hop organizer. He has served as a White House intern under President Bill Clinton and currently serves as the CEO on the Hip-Hop Caucus in Washington, D.C. Reverend Yearwood was a national grassroots and political director of the Russell Simmons Hip-Hop Summit Action Group, was a senior consultant for P. Diddy's Citizen Change and Jay-Z's Voice for Choice. We could go on and on, but first of all, I'd like to thank you for being with us this evening, Reverend.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. You were arrested on Capitol Hill. Can you tell us what the charges were that they charged you for before we go into some of the details as to what happened that day, sir?
Yes, well, it's important to note that one of the things that I was an officer in the U.S. Air Force, and so obviously I'm now a part of a group called Iraq Vets or Veterans Against the War, and so that's just an important note because I recognize how important the hearing on House Armed Services is, especially with General Petraeus speaking, and so. On September 10th, I went to just hear the hearing. I mean, obviously, I have been on Capitol Hill, and obviously, my role in the anti-war movement is growing, and so obviously, they knew who I was, and obviously, I had just actually beat the Air Force. The Air Force tried to discharge me because of my speaking out against this war and against this president for putting us in this war. They tried to discharge him with conduct unbecoming an officer. And obviously they tried to discharge him with behavior inconsistent with the interests of national security and dishonorable. And so I just actually had just won that literally a few weeks before this. They had to discharge him with honorable based upon my service. And so then I was hearing this hearing. I was in line. And while being in line, I was actually stopped from getting into the hearing. And that was the point there when I asked, why was I being singled out? Why couldn't I get in? Literally, the Capitol Police officers began to beat on me, which was amazing, in the hallways of Congress. And it was just sad because, for me, it felt bad for a number of reasons. One, the group that I work with now, its whole goal was to try to get more young people and people of color more involved with democracy, more involved in making government more transparent. So a lot of work has gone on and gone into this. As most people know, my background, I was one of the co-creators of the Vote or Die campaign with Diddy. And so, you know, that's what I've been doing for quite some time. And so to be there for me, to be lying in the halls of Congress being beaten, while as an officer, to be lying in the halls of Congress while another officer, in my opinion, was lying to Congress, was amazing. And so, you know, they sit there. But the great thing about it is that because of the cameras, it was caught on YouTube. And so everybody can go to YouTube and see it for themselves and see what happened. But that was fantastic. And I would say that, you know, the revolution may not be televised, but it will be uploaded. So the great thing is that actually hundreds of thousands of people around the world tuned into that, began to call the Capitol Hill police, began to call Speaker Pelosi, and then recently all charges for us, they had charges of assaulting a police officer. And those charges were just dismissed. And so it was really a triumph on both occasions. My one occasion with me being discharged as a national security risk in the Air Force and winning that, and then showing up and just being beaten in the halls of Congress and having people literally chiming in together, and we beating that, it really is a triumph for the people.
Well, first of all, congratulations on being a member of such an honorable group of veterans. We've had many of the vets against the Iraqi War on our show. Kelly Daugherty, Prentice Reed, Lieutenant Aaron Watata, and others have joined us on our show, and it's an honor having you as well. What injuries did you sustain that day, sir?
I received, well, other than just the pain of and the embarrassment, I mean, literally, of being beaten in the halls.
Wrestled to the ground.
And, yeah. And I received torn ligaments in my ankle, and just a series of just, I mean, I didn't know at the time, but I had six or seven officers who literally jumped on me. And you have to understand that one of the things that happened is that for me, by being an activist, but being a person of color, I really, it felt more like 1957 than it did like 2007, which was horrific, because it, to me, it felt like this is what democracy while black looks like. And so it really was troubling. So the not just the physical, but just the emotional pain of literally for me as somebody who has fought for, who has defended, to literally be in that position now standing up, it was horrific.
During the time that you were standing in line, sir, you were asked—you had gotten permission from the coordinators there to step out of line to do a radio interview, and you spoke about them giving post-it notes. What was the purpose of the post-it notes that they were giving you?
Yeah, that was the thing. So just like this, I'm doing an interview right now. I was doing a interview while in line. We were there for quite some time. And we were in line, and so I was doing an interview, and then it was just, obviously, it was just noisy. If anybody's been in the halls of Congress, there's this marble floors and marble walls, so it's, the sound can ricochet. And so I asked the officer if I can just step to the side, and he said, no problem. And the great thing, all this was caught on tape, too, is what people were sitting in tapes. I caught that on tape. And so I moved, and then I came back, and I got in line. And what was also caught on tape was that the officer just came up to me and says, "You're not getting in," and walked away. And that was, and I was like, "What's going on?" He said, and he just literally, this is way before even what happens. He said, "You're not getting in," and he walks away. And then he comes down the line and begins to pass out these post-it notes. And he just literally, I guess, reached in his pocket and pulled out. And it's important to note that I used to be a White House intern. So, with the Bill Clinton administration. So, in that position, I know the line process very well. And so, but this was new. I mean, these post-it notes, like this whole process.
So the post-it notes was not something that had ever happened before.
That's not a normal thing. And so,
okay.
You know, that was just something they just kind of, and they were just doing that to then, and it wasn't just me. It's important to know. People didn't understand that. Literally, they were literally segregating the peace activists. And that was what was more troubling, because obviously the group Code Pink has been doing a wonderful job. Just doing theater and really antagonizing and making sure that the peace movement is not the path of least resistance. And so these wonderful women have been just really agitating and really just kind of pushing the envelope. So I was frustrating the system, rightfully so, because in a time when literally thousands of troops are dying, and for me in my role as someone who performed as a chaplain who sees the crying, who hears the parents when they hear the news that their child has been killed. And you can't imagine how painful it is to know when your 20-year-old child or son or daughter has been killed in a war that is unjust. And, or on the other side, the Iraqis who are now with the refugees or literally thousands, hundreds of thousands or millions by some accounts of people who have been killed or exterminated within a four-year span. And so they are standing up. So Code Pink is standing up in this process. So they were trying to cut down the cold take number, and that's also on the tape. They were trying to say you can only have in seven peace activists. And so they literally singled out some of the cold take activists, and then they singled out me and Colonel Ann Wright are the ones that they actually were singling out.
Now, Colonel Wright was with
you. Yeah.
Colonel Wright, Ann Wright was with you at the time. You had come to this event together, if I'm not mistaken.
We came around the same time. We actually came.
She came
and I both came. We didn't come together, but we came around the same time.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah, we came at the same time and this got in line. And
so basically they were tagging you. If you had a post-it note, you got in. If you didn't have, if you weren't tagged with a post-it note, you didn't get in.
No, exactly. And that was the thing. So you... So they were passing out the post-it notes, so they didn't give one to me, for instance, and Colonel Ann Wright. And that's when this whole thing begins to really unravel. And it was tense. You had to understand the atmosphere with Jennifer Petraeus, and they really wanted it, and they had constructed it. You have to understand, they had put the people coming in, it was the largest Cannon hearing room in the Cannon office building. I'm on Capitol Hill, and they literally had put it so that when you came in, you were in the very back row. So they had it so if you were going to disrupt, if you were going to speak out, if you were going to say, if you heard something that was not right, if that was the case. And it's important to note that I didn't even come, that, you know, there are times when I have been arrested on Capitol Hill against this war, or for impeachment. But that, at all, on the 10th, I was just actually coming to hear, because I recognize that when generals lie, soldiers die. And so I just really wanted to hear the report so I can report back, particularly back to, you know, people like you and to Urban Radio about what I heard in the hearing. And so the post-it note was given, was literally passed over certain activists.
Well, you know, I happen to have witnessed the event on YouTube during the very week that it happened, and I was appalled and astounded. And one of the things that was the most disturbing was how peacefully you had reacted to all of it, right up until the time that they were literally throwing you down on the ground. All you were doing is asking, why am I being arrested? Why can't I come in? Why? You were asking them questions in a very mild, very even tone. You weren't being abusive. You weren't being abrasive. And it almost seems like how did you get from questioning these people to down on the ground with six police officers on top of you? It was literally as quickly as that and as unbelievable, almost surreal as that, and I'm astounded by the brutality that they used on, for all intents and purposes, a very peaceful man that was asking, why can't I come in? And being selectively pushed off to the side. Were you eventually able to hear the Petraeus report, either on archives or transcripts?
No, eventually. I mean, actually, that night I spent the nail in jail. I was arrested. I was taken to the emergency room because I had been pretty bruised in my ankle, pretty battered, and literally.
You thought it was broken, didn't you?
Cast and taken to jail. I was actually in the lockup, central lockup, in D.C. jail, and that was, you know, it was pretty rough, particularly with, you know, being banged up. You know, the only thing I think that was good about that was that because it had got on TV in the D.C. area, a lot of people who maybe were being locked up saw it. Hey, man, you the rebel who got beat up by the cops. It was a unique experience in jail.
Your claim to fame. all the things that you have done, and here's your claim to fame, that you got beat up by the Capitol Hill police.
That's
disturbing.
It was the people's response. I think that's the thing. The people's response. I mean, literally hundreds of thousands of people looked at the YouTube video. And so while we have a media blockout and sometimes it's very strategic, it was amazing. And I will say this. There are times that I felt love. While I do believe that the way that I was reacted to was because, in some cases, the natural split-second reaction to, I am a very peaceful person, you know, and I wear my collar, and I'm a reverend. I am physically, I'm not a big man, but I mean, and I'm not a small man either. I'm 5'10", 230, and my day is from the Air Force. And so, you know, I think that split second that they just, it just clicked that, okay, then this is a guy, and I think I actually do believe that this is a black person, and then I was leaped on. On the flip side of that, the reception I got from people like from Trans Africa, Amnesty International, Code Pink, Progressive Democrats of America, black and white, Asian and Latino, male and female, straight and gay, there was the outcry that I received was amazing. So on one hand, where I felt like that instant, that leap on and that push down was one where it felt like it was a throwback to 57, at the same time, the progressive response was one in which it was unifying.
Do you believe that racism plays a part in this at all, Reverend Yearwood?
I do. I mean, I don't think it plays. I think in that, I mean, obviously there is, unfortunately, you know, when we are still dealing with, you know, racism. I do believe, though, it's different. I do believe that while we're dealing with racism and we're dealing with white supremacy, I do also believe that we are the generation, my generation, those of us who are in the 30s and 20s, even the 40s, our generation where we are the first generation where you have the sons and daughters of former slave owners working side by side with the sons and daughters of former slaves. I do believe that. I do believe that we are a generation and we are a society that can end racism, that we can come together. So while there is racism, and I do believe that there is, I believe that that split-second decision, that leaping on, where does that just come from? Where does that just leaping on mentality just come from? Comes from, I think, a lack of respect for people of color. But on the other hand, I do believe that the progressive movement coming together as black and white, Asian, Latino, was also a leaping on in itself to push back against racism. So on one hand, while racism exists, on the other hand, you have a pushing back against racism as well.
Let me ask you, you said in one interview, Reverend Yearwood, that we are evolving beyond war, racism, and evolving past poverty. Yet we may be as a people evolving, but if the administration of America has not evolved, and I hardly call President George W. Bush an evolved being, what's to be done and how do we change this?
Well, I think the first thing is that I do believe, and I think you're right. I believe that one, I think war is obsolete, and I truly believe that. But I think war is a mechanism that should be used for foreign diplomacy or foreign policy. I think now war in the 21st century is an obsolete means of interacting in this day and age. I also believe that judging each other by the color of one's hue or is not, I think, is also something that we are getting past. I think that we are becoming a much better generation where black and white and others are beginning to, are coming together, still very different, but are coming together. And I do believe that we can, as far as extreme poverty, because of our understanding and our resources, we can have an impact on poverty. With that being said, because obviously we must deal with America, we must deal with imperialism, we must deal with these things, and in some cases out of control capitalism, because of that, those are things that are still hostile and actually push forth racism and militarism and poverty. And so we must deal with that as well. And I think that is why the people, what you are now seeing is in essence a line is being drawn around the globe. You're now seeing literally either organized money or organized people. And I think you're seeing that. You've seen that in Dakar, in Senegal. You've seen that in the Congo. You've seen that in Saudi Arabia, in Venezuela. You've seen that here in America, Australia, France, Pakistan, China. You've seen it around the world. You've seen this fine line in Burma with the Burma monks who, for me as a person of faith, I mean, that's where I take my marching orders from, like these Burmese monks. You're seeing this line being drawn up around the globe. And it's a line that's being drawn up between organized money, capitalism, and this usurpatory mentality versus organized people, a place where humanity can thrive. You can see it within politics here in America, where I think you're seeing this process where even now I think that we're recognizing that you just can't change the people, but we must change the structure. We saw within this past election in 2006. And so what we're now beginning to see, that a Democrat Congress can't get it done, a Republican Congress can't get it done. We need a human Congress. We need a Congress that puts humanity at the forefront. And so these things are happening. So I think this is, I think what you're seeing now is a tremendous, to me, it's an exciting time as we are evolving as beings. I think it's an amazing time to be alive. At the same time, it's also the worst time. We have fascism on the rise. We have excess on the rise. We have exploitation on the rise. And so all these things are coming together, and I think literally, and I believe this, what happens now, 7 years into the 21st century, will literally determine if we have a 22nd century. This is the line being drawn. Humanity is on the line.
Reverend, do you believe that day that some form of distraction was inevitable as a method of diversion from the Petraeus statements about Iraq?
As far as you mean, as far as the
as far as the event that happened with you, that even that any kind of distraction would not have been unheard of, just to take away the pressure of the statements of the general.
Do you think that
it was okay by the Capitol Hill police to have a disturbance?
To have a disturbance? Well, it was outside. I mean, there were people who were going inside to the hearing who were getting arrested inside, who did get inside.
Thereby taking away some of the impact of the general statements, correct?
If I'm understanding correctly, that is correct. I mean, I think they were, the bottom line to it is that I think that there's something going on in which they obviously want to give an image back to not only the country but to the world, that they are in control and that the people here are not responding. It's important to note that I actually went back last week. Because obviously, while I was very fearful and I didn't really want to go back, in some cases I have to do my job since my job requires me to report on what happens on Capitol Hill, I went to the Blackwater hearing and literally was stopped again from going into the Blackwater hearing. And it took Congresswoman Maxine Waters to come out herself and escort me in. So I think that there are pieces that are there that I think they're very worried about prominent faces. Obviously, Sidney Sheehan gets the same response as well. When she gets there, she's blocked, and Colonel Ann Wright gets that as well. So I think they're trying to block out certain things in the process. And
I think they're trying to block out freedom of speech is what they're trying to block out.
No, I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, they're literally trying to block out the people's right to assembly and obviously people's right to speech.
The people's right, you know, on C-SPAN not too long ago, some of the members of Code Pink were escorted off of the stage as they delivered a peaceful message of protest as to some statements that were made at a conference that was being held about the Iraqi and the Iraqi death toll. Now, these people were escorted out, and I understand that. I can understand. But to not allow you in, to not
no,
start
I,
you
I
right
agree.
At the
I think
door
let's go to the premise of what this is setting up. If this precedent is allowed to be carried out, and we are literally blocked from going to public hearings, and our government becomes, in essence, hidden away from public view. That is how fascism really begins to rise. And so, you know, this is why this is so dangerous. It is one thing to go inside the, you're right, to go inside the hearing and to disrupt, to, in other words, exercise your freedom of speech. And then they have the right to then say, hey, you're disorderly, we have to conduct business. You know, you can like it, you can don't like it, and they can remove you.
Exactly. Exactly.
But on the other hand, to literally block you from coming in, either thinking you're going to disrupt or whatever, is really you know, out of place. And in particularly my case, I think why it's very dangerous in this specific situation, a number of the vets who are coming back are being targeted. You mentioned Watada, Adam Kokesh, myself, a number of the vets themselves, Colonel Ann Wright, she just tried to get into Canada recently and was not allowed in. And that's my
Colonel Wright was also on our show, did an interview with us, by the way.
No, wonderful. You're getting all the good ones.
She's,
you got a great
show. An incredible woman. One thing, what I'm trying to get to here is your rights were violated. You were presumed guilty prior to your entrance. Here you are, an intern that worked these lines before, that has firsthand knowledge and experience of how these lines worked. They've introduced a new system. They've got these post-it notes, which sound very Nazi-like to me, I don't know, and I know that the Nazi word is being thrown around a lot, but let's post a note on you and tell you you can enter and you cannot. Sounds pretty Nazi-like to me, I don't care what anybody says. And when you were being escorted, you did nothing. All you did was ask a question, and I agree. I think what they are trying to say is, don't mess with us because we will come down on you and we will come down on you hard. But the worst problem here is that your rights were violated, that you were presumed guilty before you even entered and had an opportunity to be disruptive, to break any laws of protocol or decorum. You didn't do any of those things. All you did was stand in line and wait your turn. Now,
that's the beginning, because what will end up happening next is that I was in line, being singled out. You're not being allowed in. You're not being allowed. If you watch the tape, one thing that I even said to them, I said, I'm a citizen. I mean, you know, hey, I'm a citizen. I have a right to be in this line. I have a right to go to this hearing. But you're right. This begins to set a very dangerous precedent when you begin, because then what happens next? I get a knock at my door. Am I rounded up at home in my pajamas?
Because
saying,
you may possibly do something at one point in time.
Yeah,
and that's the point.
And then we need to round you up because we don't need to. We need to make sure that the public can see. And this is happening a lot in Washington. There are two things that are really happening in Washington that to me are very alarming. The first thing is this: that there is this. They're just trying to control the atmosphere. Just again, that freedom of really trying to censor freedom of speech or quell freedom of speech. That's one thing, and really keep out activists or try to disrupt in that aspect. The other thing that's been happening too is that in recent times there's been a huge military presence in Washington. We know that there's been a call up of one of the National Guards that didn't go to Iraq, that actually came to Washington instead. And in Washington, where we are, it's a very noticeable military presence. I mean, they don't have guns, they're not walking around, but you can very much notice on the subways and in the streets of D.C. that there is a huge, there's only a number of people who, I mean, I was stationed in the D.C. area when I was in the Air Force, but there's a very noticeable presence, a military presence walking the streets of D.C. And there's a noticeable, much more presence of the SWAT team type of look that is also patrolling the streets of D.C. And this is not just for the alleged, you know, the war on terror per se, but this is something different. And I think that we have to be very cautious what is going on. And people are noticing it. I mean, there are people who are in D.C. who are coming up to me and saying, hey, Rev, you know, I'm just wondering, you just notice all those people in the military? You know, and people are noticing it. There's just a huge number of military personnel around the streets. And then, and so there's something that's very disturbing about what is happening. And we're seeing something that looks very bad. Looks very, very bad.
You know, when you said that they seem to be targeting a lot of the veterans that are coming back, as far as I'm aware, there are over 3,000 Americans per year to date deserting the military. There must be a reason for such a high volume of deserters. Do you believe that that's why they are targeting some of the vets? Because they don't want the word out. They don't want people to know what is going on and what's making so many Americans desert the military and desert the service of their country.
Well, no, I totally agree with that. I think that obviously they don't want the word out, obviously. I think also this administration and this grouping understands the power of the media. They understand that the media has the power to make the innocent guilty and the guilty innocent, and the ability to move the masses. So obviously they're censoring the media, and obviously they're obviously using that in there. And so in that world, you have this strange situation where they're targeting the military. And they're keeping it very under. I know that when my case began to come out with me, and when my lawyers came to do pushback against, you know, when they tried to, when they first came at me to say that I was a behavior that was inconsistent with the interests of national security, when they first came and told me that, and then when we pushed back, and people began to organize around that, they backed away. Adam Kokesh, I think in Watata's case as well, even though they're going forward, I think his court martial, but there's a number of these cases that are like that. And so I do believe they're targeting, but they also recognize if they don't want to use a draft. And so, and not trying to use a draft, they've now begin to put together either this quote unquote volunteer force, they always like to talk about, or these contractors, the Blackwater, that is there as well. And so in putting this piece together, they're very cautious. They're very strategic in how they're keeping it out of the view of the public. So they're literally, you know, I told this to some students the other day I was speaking with, and I told them, I said, the one thing about what went on in Germany is that it was in Europe. And what's going on, unfortunately, with Iraq, is that it's not. And so you don't have all the countries around it who can begin to speak out. And I think we should now begin to see from Afghanistan to Iraq to now literally the rhetoric going up against Iran, it is really becoming a dangerous time. And so the targeting of servicemen in particular, and on the other hand, the lowering of standards for servicemen, because you need to understand that there's also a situation in which a lot of us, to meet their recruiting goals, because I think people have been very good at counter-recruitment. To meet their recruiting goals, they're bringing in people who are in, they're lowering the standards, they're bringing in members from gangs. We know that there was a gang initiation in Baghdad where a Crip, a young guy who was killed in Baghdad, listening into a gang. We know that there are numbers of those who are part of the white supremacist groups. Now, even before, you couldn't have a tattoo. They're now relaxing that. They're getting a number of morality waivers, which is probably how, you know, President Bush got into office. But we got a lot of morality waivers that are being thrown around. And so now you even have, they found out you have a lot of white supremacists who are now going into the military, and they're being told to get all the military training you can get. And why? To prepare when you come home for the race wars. Go and and get all the training you can get. Going into the military with swastikas on their arm, known rapists now being admitted to the military. And this is not what our military should be used for. And so this is what we've allowed to happen. So it is a very dangerous time that we are approaching with our country.
Well, it sounds like a very frightening time, and I'm telling you, we just had a show done about the recruiting policies of the recruiters in our country, and to say that they are at the very least unscrupulous is, I think, an undercharacterization. The other thing that I'm concerned about is when we hear these stories about people literally infiltrating the military to get training. Our concern here is, are we in the end going to be turning against ourselves? And the one other thing that I think is very important is, you know, this is a classic case of our American government, the administration of this country, not supporting the American troops. How can you be supporting the American troops if you only support the ones you choose to support? And I think that's a frightful situation. We have a caller on the line. Our first call is from Shelley of Ontario, Canada. Thank you for calling, Shelley. Your question to the Reverend Lennox Yearwood, please.
Good evening, Reverend Yearwood. What are your views on the pronounced and growing government-imposed racial prejudices in our society? I was just wondering, too, what, in your opinion, could we do as a possible solution or an action to curb this? It is a growing problem. It's evident. Thanks for allowing me to ask you.
No, I think that's a wonderful question. I think that obviously what we saw in Gina, and particularly here, I was born, you should know, also, I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. So you might hear my little southern accent come out every once in a while. But I'm not that far from Gina. So obviously I know the climate, but you're right. It is a very growing concern, and it's something that I think we must fight against. I think that we refuse to allow racism was disastrous in the 20th century, and I think we need to stand up and block it from entering into the 21st century the way it was in the 20th century. But I think that what we have to do, and this is actually a very frank piece, I think, for the progressive movement. I think that the progressive movement has to come together. One of the most disheartening things that I've seen is that when I would go to the anti-war rallies, obviously I'm a vet, I'm obviously a member of the peace movement, but 90% of the audience at the peace rally would be white. When I would go to the immigration rallies, it would be 90% would be brown. And when I went to the recent Gina rallies or police brutality rallies or Katrina rallies, 90% would be black. And so the first thing that we must do as a progressive movement, is that our progressive movement, we cannot have a segregated progressive movement. That is an oxymoron, and we must really fight that. We must begin to work together. It can't be the immigration rally, it can't be all brown, the police brutality can't be all black, Katrina can't be all black, and obviously the peace movement can't be all white. So we must bridge that gap. We must find a way for ourselves to come together as a progressive movement and work together. And so that's me. And for the progressive movement, race has been the tripwire for the progressive movement. It's that one thing that, unfortunately, I believe firmly that this president and this vice president should be impeached for their disastrous and criminal activity as they've handled their administration. And so I was recently before we went to John Conyers. To literally almost beg him in his position on the Judiciary Committee to literally put impeachment on the table. I can't understand why Pelosi took impeachment off the table, but to put impeachment on the table to really hold this president accountable so that the precedent can't be set. Because we recognize if there is no rule of law, then there's no law at all. So, you know, then we went to him. And so when I know a number of white activists who went and stood to him, they were called racist because they literally went to Congressman Conyers, who's black. But I think that's a problem because I don't think it's not a black or white issue. It was a right or wrong issue. It's impeachment. And so as a progressive movement, too easily, we can't get into certain issues. And it doesn't mean that we're not understanding of the historical implications of race, particularly with this country from slavery to now. But it does mean that as a progressive movement, we must be able to hold accountable all of us so that the Congressional Black Caucus, which sometimes acts more like the corporate Black Caucus than a Congressional Black Caucus, must be held accountable. Obviously, you have a Maxine Waters and a Barbara Lee and a Shudex and Lee who are fantastic. And as fantastic as they can be, you have others, like, you know, Bobby Rush and Mel Watt and so many others who are not so fantastic. And so we have to be able to hold them accountable for their actions. And if people who are of a lighter hue or white say anything about that, say, hey, you know, how is it Congressman Rush used to be a Black Panther and now in the hands of all these telecommunication companies. Something is wrong with that. Or Congressman Jefferson in New Orleans, you know, is not taking care of certain things. Something is wrong with that. We should be able to have that dialogue and without being afraid of race. And so that's the first thing. On the other hand, particularly for progressive activists who are white, they must recognize, they must begin to support organizations that are coming up in the community, that they can't have a paternalism mentality to other organizations, and that must be stopped. And one of the things, unfortunately, and I hope this will bring about some good discussion, is that the reality too in our progressive movement is that the change between the 60s and the 70s and now is that a lot of it used to be for passion in the 60s, and now we've gone from passion to a paycheck, and we have now created time card activists who are only involved in this process, not because they literally want to see the people free and power to the people, but only want to be involved because it just takes care of them, and they're not in the little 9-to-5 mentality is not going to do anything. And that has a problem, particularly when you now have, when we have a military-industrial complex, we're now forming sometimes an NGO-industrial complex. And so we must really deal with these things as we're dealing with race and as a progressive community. And when we deal with these things and we begin to come together and support our movements, either by race or by issue, and that's important also, healthcare issue, poverty issue, climate issue, I'm so proud to be a part of a group that's doing the No War, No Warming coming together with climate and the war coming together, which will be, yes, you can look at the website, nowarnowarming.org. But so important for us to come together. Once we do that, then we as a progressive community can challenge the issue of race and racism.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next caller is Sue from Massachusetts. Sue, your question for the Reverend Lennox Yearwood, please.
Thank you, Basima. Reverend, I love your passion. I love the way how you are so passionate about what you're doing, and I want to thank you for being with us this evening. My question is simply this. There has been an arrest of Code Pink members for reading the First Amendment in Washington, D.C., and I'm just curious, and if this arrest of the Code Pink people may have been a reaction to your own recent NC at the Petraeus hearings. Thank you, sir, and I really appreciate you speaking with us. Your mic, sir.
Yes, I do. I really do believe that the current, you know, that Code Pink again, has been this phenomenal in their approach to activism in the halls of Congress. And I think before and after, I think before I was arrested, it's important to note that when I was arrested, the week was a huge anti-war rally on the 15th as well. So there was a lot of excitement in the air. But Code Pink, I think, helped. I think somehow my arrest got charged up because of that environment. And I think following that, I think it has been. I think on the Hill since then, my arrest in particular, there's been a spotlight on the tactics. And I would tell everyone that they should really call Speaker Pelosi. They should really call her office and really say that I am truly worried about the tactics. The Capitol Hill police come under her as the Speaker of the House. The Capitol Hill police come under her jurisdiction. And so we should really be calling Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And I think as people have been doing that, but more we should be calling and saying that what I'm seeing, what's going on with Reverend Yearwood, with Code Pink, with other activists, particularly peace activists who are peaceful, a lot of them being beaten up, a lot of them literally being are being hurt. I mean, a lot of them, how they're treating a lot of the women in Code Pink, how they're literally, when they are just reading the Constitution, and how they're being just dragged away. I mean, ridiculous treatment for people who are very peaceful. I think we should really begin to call Speaker Pelosi and just voice our outrage to this type of this police state tactics that are going on. But I do believe that Code Pink before and after my particular arrest has, in essence, charged the environment of really trying to shut down freedom of speech.
Thank you, Reverend. Our next caller is Mike from California.
Thank you, Basima. Reverend Yearwood, I understand that you once worked with P. Diddy and Jay-Z. How politically active are they? I mean, you of all must know how many people they could reach through their music, making an announcement at a award ceremony, or coming out and speaking, recording some kind of announcement, calling for an end to the war in Iraq, marching with you. What about it? Do you stay in touch with them? Will they speak out? Thank you.
No, that's an excellent question. I am in touch with some of them, some more than others. Obviously, people are at different levels. Obviously, in the African-American community in general, I would want to be more present. So obviously, they have a very high opinion rate against this war, but the public involvement doesn't show in protests or in activities. So obviously, not just with Jay-Z, but also with the communities of color. And I would say that part of that is also dealing with the war at home and the war abroad. There's two different things. So when we have discussions with them, they usually will tell me, they will say, well, Rev, you know that we're dealing with Deshaun Bells. I know you're dealing with Baghdad, but we're dealing with Sean Bell being shot 50 times, or Gina, or Tukey Williams in California, or whatever might be the case. And they'll mention the domestic side. And so one of the things I'm trying to link is that the bombs dropping in Baghdad are affecting our community, that literally that the money that's going to an illegal war, as I tell them, is literally money that could go to pay for teachers and schools and health care. And so that is beginning to link. And there are artists who are very much with me who are there. David Banner, obviously, is, I'm just giving you some A-list artists, Dave Chappelle, Mos Def, Immortal Technique, Dead Prez, from L.A., Mystic, and some others. So, I mean, there is, it's a lot of hard work, I'm going to tell you. I don't get a lot of sleep, but it's a lot of hard work. But, you know, what keeps me going is the fact of the matter that I really can't sleep at night knowing that all the Iraqis, when I just came back recently, actually, from the Middle East, and I saw the devastation on the Iraqi people, that drives me. So it would be good if Jay-Z and others were more vocal. I would also say this, that there's a corporate side, as you know, within this, and so a lot of them are controlled, and they don't have the ability or really the true freedom you might think they have. Some of them might have. I mean, I think they have it personally. I think they have it. I think they have to step out there. I think they must be the Harry Belafonte's that I tell them, or the Paul Robesons, or when I talk to some of the athletes. We do have the Eton Thomas, who plays for the Washington Wizards, who is probably one of the most outspoken people against this war. You should look up his poetry. At the same time, I talk to other athletes and tell them, you must be the Muhammad Ali of our generation. But it's a process. It is a process. But I do think that this is why the Hip Hop Caucus was formed. This is the reason, so we can obviously make government more transparent. We can have an inside-outside approach to Capitol Hill. Barbara Lee is our advisory board chair. I'm actually very proud to say that the Hip Hop Caucus, as a progressive organization, has the all woman advisory board, because we actually want to trust women leadership, which is very powerful. It's a process. But you know, we have not that we don't have all the resources, and so obviously, those are listening, they want to support the caucus, please. We can use all the help we can use at hiphopcaucus.org. But it is a process, and I think that we are moving forward. And I think that as we can begin to link the dots between poverty and this war, between police brutality in the secret prisons in Iraq or in Guantanamo, with the prison system here in America, with police brutality and at Abu Ghraib, with the police brutality in Gina or in Oakland. And so we're trying to link the dots. It takes a little time. I will also say this, too. A lot of the institutions and the communities of color have become ineffective. A lot of the institutions, from the churches to some of the civil rights institutions, they have become institutionalized. And so there are some phenomenal churches, there are some phenomenal organizations, but unfortunately a lot of the other ones have become institutionalized, and in that aren't really leading the banner. And so there is also a ton of superficial leadership within communities of color as well, and that's also a huge problem. And so when you have that, they're not really translating. So while my voice is there, it would be great if other voices who are as powerful or as out there in the media spotlight, they were also saying, get involved in the war effort or peace movement. I think that would have also impact as well.
Well, you know, we do have one more caller, Sue from Massachusetts. But before she takes the line, what I'd like to say is another connection, and I don't know if we're connecting dots or we're connecting dollar bills here, Reverend, but another connection would be the predominant majority of black soldiers that have traditionally joined the armed forces. That's a big speaking factor there. We've only got a few more minutes, Reverend, and we want to take one more call from Sue from Massachusetts. Thank you for calling again, Sue.
Thank you, Basma. Reverend, I'm going to put it to you straight. With your arrest, with the arrest of Code Pink, are we now under martial law, or are we in fact headed towards martial law? Your answer, please, sir.
Yeah, I think that we're headed. I think we're headed without any breaks. I think that it's obvious that with what's going on with Code Pink and my arrests, which have been more out in the public view, and the other arrests. I mean, there have been other arrests like that that have been as disgusting, but haven't gotten the notoriety because of the people, or whatever. But have been just as bad. We are headed toward martial law, toward a police state. And I don't use this word lightly, a Gestapo-type mentality. We're headed there, and we're seeing that. Hence the reason why I think we should call and put the pressure on Speaker Pelosi and tell her that we just refuse to have this martial law, this police state environment.
You know, there's so many issues that we have to address, and one of the things that I would like to question you briefly about, we've only got a couple minutes left, but did you believe it when he said, when General Petraeus said that no one saw the report prior to that day? And if this is true, is a lone man in charge of the course of events in Iraq a wise thing to do? I mean, does he have that kind of power?
No, I don't believe it. I mean, obviously, I mean, part of the after scenes report, I mean, I'll say is that they're playing, I mean, obviously there's a lot of factors and a lot of reasons for what is happening. Probably to draw down our troops, our capacity. There's no more troops to send in some cases. I mean, there's literally at a point where we have exhausted our troop levels. And so a number of things he said, but I don't agree that he was the only one who saw that, and I think that was the huge problem when you have generals who can become political pawns. And so, and I said before, when generals lie, soldiers die. And unfortunately, since he has given his report, more young men, babies, mama's babies and daddy's babies have lost their lives and will never come back home. To walk around on the streets. And so this is disastrous. This is a terrible time, and we must continue to speak up and speak out. We must organize, we must mobilize, we must energize at this moment in history. Humanity is on the line. This is not a time to sit home and be pontificating or talking about or being academic in all cases. This is a time when we must take the streets. We must even take the suites. But we must make sure that our voices as the people are gone. Or, if we do not do that, our generation, this time in history, will be looked upon as the one of the weakest moments for the people in history and as the path of least resistance. So I believe that we must come together now and stand up for justice and fight what is going on. These lies, this unjust, and this behavior of creating fascism in the 21st century.
Well, I want for myself and for our audience to thank you, Reverend, for not only being with us this evening, but for being the citizen that you are, for serving your country, and coming back and telling the truth about what you saw, and standing up to any resistance of that, and as we can see. And for those of you that have never seen the attack on Reverend Lennox Yearwood, it is on YouTube. We have been posting it in the virtual auditorium. And I behoove you to go and see and witness what our country is being reduced to. And is that acceptable for you as an American? If it is, then maybe we should just shut down our doors and do no more shows. Our guest tonight, Reverend Lennox Yearwood, thank you, sir, for being with us tonight. Next week's guest is going to be Betsy Meyer, the former President Clinton advisor and Senator Barack Obama's spokesperson for the campaign of 2008. That's Tuesday, October 16th at 8:30 to 9:30 Eastern. Thank you all for being with us, and let's continue to speak. When the people speak, we make a difference. Thank you very much.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.